From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codenamed Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. This is our first listener mail segment of 2021, or the first we're recording in 2021. And we have a cavalcade of strange stories and fascinating feedback from the best part of the show, your fellow listeners. Before we begin, guys, I know I told you about this off air, but for years, and I mean years, since I started at this job as an intern, How Stuff Works and iHeart now have been kind of in a low-level prank war. Sometimes we'll come in and things will just be a little weird. One time we smuggled, I think we used this example on the show before, so it's okay to say it. One time we smuggled a very large Elvis impersonator in to prank our boss. We did a ghost, like remote control operated whoopee cushion back in the day. And today I snuck into the office to get some coffee and I was drinking out of this cup, or I was about to, when my paranoia paid off and I looked at the bottom to see someone had popped. How would you describe that? What does it look like, a 6, maybe a 9?
Yeah, it depends on which way you hold it, but it's like they did it with like the pointy end of a compass or something, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Huh. Ben.
Some stabby implement of some kind. Very precise work. I got to give them props.
True.
Everyone listening, you have to know that most of these things happen to Ben for some reason. So
That's not true. No, yeah, everybody gets it.
Yeah.
Everybody gets it. Noel got a weird stalkery parrot thing.
Yeah,
recently.
We have these little like squishy ball things for stress, and they're shaped like the iHeartRadio parrot, which is apparently our mascot, which I wasn't aware of. But they're just littered all over the office, and someone collected a whole bunch of them and lined them up next to each other and snipped off their little parrot faces and lined those up in front of their little parrot bodies. And I don't know if you guys know this about me, but not a fan of birds, so it felt very threatening. It was sort of like a horse head in the bed kind of situation.
Hmm. No, dude, they were whoever this was, I'm sure they love you very much, and they were trying to show you that the birds were neutralized. And
like a cat. Like a cat. They're teaching you to hunt sponge stress birds. But you know, you found out who that was, right? That investigation was successful.
Yeah, but they denied it vehemently for a time, and then finally came clean.
And that had a happy ending. So on the off chance, any of our coworkers listen to the show, and on the off chance, whomever is responsible for this is listening to the show, then all I have to say is, nice one, close call, you almost got me, but you're talking about one of the most paranoid people in our network. I did, Matt, I want to be honest, suspect you at first, like from the jump.
Oh, you did? Well, I mean, I generally am not the kind of person that would do that. So, you know.
Yeah. Okay, that's, you're generally not, but what about specifically? We digress. But it was heartwarming, you know, because I think a lot of us had a tough time over the holidays, not being able to be with the people that we usually see toward the end of the year. We typically get together at least once as a group at our local dive bar or someplace, and we just grab a couple drinks and wax on about the world and the state of things. So, these pranks were nice, but I'm going to find who it was. I have a strong suspicion based on an off-air lead.
Well, I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you. Thank you. And likewise. So today we want to share some amazing stories from your fellow listeners. We have some stuff at the very forefront of medicine, or depending on who you ask, very ancient medicinal practices. We have some stuff about very big brother level surveillance. And then we have a story that may not be, I'm just going to be honest with you folks, may not be suitable for all listeners, taking place in the United Nations. So
Where do you think we go first, guys? What do you think?
Why don't we begin at all the stuff that we do on the internet and who's been looking at it since the turn of the millennium? Because, you know, we are two decades now in. We're in the third decade already. How weird is that? Ugh.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the third decade of the 2000s. Okay, that's fine.
Woo!
Wait, hey, really quickly, though. So we're not in the aughts anymore, right? Or wait.
No.
What are we in now? What do we call it?
The teens, maybe.
I don't think it's been coined yet. No?
Wait, we can't call it the teens because that was like 2018, 2019.
That's right. We're in the 20s. This is the new 20s.
We're in the roaring 20s.
Yeah.
Get me a flapper dress and feed me some moonshine. That's what I say.
Looking at the parallels of the 1918 pandemic and the roaring 1920s, let's say you have about 8 or 9 years to prepare for whatever the version of the 30s are. Students of history, you will doubtlessly appreciate that gloom and doom, shout out to human tragedy and its cyclical nature.
Yeah. And in that spirit, let's look back at the turn of the millennium. And just get a quick story from someone who called in.
Oh, did that beep? Okay. My brother was kind of abducted, sort of, by the CIA in the early 2000s because he was too good at computers. And so he was getting international recognition. They picked him up. They said, hey, you have to come with us. Otherwise, we're going to put you in detention because you'd be a national security risk. And they put him into a fold working on the TIA program, Total Information Awareness. I'm curious as to whether or not you guys have done episodes on TIA before and what happened to it after it was supposedly disbanded by Congress. The entire time my brother was working for the CIA, he could not talk to anyone, including family or his wife or his children, about what he was doing. And then when Congress disbanded it, he was able to talk to people. I'm wondering what happened after that. He was taken out of this program and put in a different cell where he was still doing the same information and programming that he was before that, but it was given different names and they didn't have access to any of the other cells, so I assume it just like presumed to go on under different nomenclature. I assume that the government's watchful eye over our doings on the internet is long and deep, like to a degree that we will never be able to comprehend as ordinary Joe Schmo layman. Probably
shouldn't
have this call. Okay, bye-bye.
Perfect ending. Yeah. I mean, wow. But hey, it's cool. Everybody uses incognito mode on your Chrome browser.
Yeah, that's fine.
That totally works, right?
Yeah, Comcast, AT&T, everybody, we're all good. Your internet service provider is not looking at that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my goodness. First of all, thank you for calling us with that story. It's incredible that this saga touched so close to home for you with your brother and his involvement in this program that you mentioned, Total Information Awareness. Now, I cut out a couple pieces of your voicemail just so you know, and so you guys know that I did that for clarity. Mm. And one of the things that our caller was asking was whether or not we've covered anything like this before in the past. And we most certainly have discussed both the NSA and their activities. We've discussed PRISM before and a couple other information awareness programs that are both aimed externally to the United States by the United States, as well as programs that are in other countries that are aimed at the United States, including Stellar Wind and a couple other things we've talked about. But I figure this is a great opportunity to really break some of that stuff down and to start back at the Total Information Awareness program that was going to be in effect. There were attempts to put this program into effect, and it did begin, in fact, functioning. But a name changed, as our caller mentions there, and, you know, the situation changed, just like what his brother experienced, where he was working inside a black box somewhere on this thing that they called Total Information Awareness. Then they changed the name, then he moved somewhere else, essentially doing the same work. So I'm going to jump to an article from the ACLU called Q&A on the Pentagon's Total Information Awareness Program.
I love this one. Yeah, this is a good one.
Yeah, it's really good, and I'm going to read some of this verbatim. Some of it you can go and check out on your own if you wish, but if you know you're being asked what it is, this is how the ACLU would describe it. It's the closest thing to a true Big Brother program that's ever been seriously contemplated within the United States. First of all, that's saying something. And yikes, alarm bells, right? It's what it will do, or what it was planning on doing, was pulling together as many different things and as many different sources of online information that people generate every day into a huge database. So bank transactions, things that you buy at your store, your credit card transactions, where you go, what you search online, all kinds of things like that. It's going to put all of that into a big database and then attempt to then go through and look through all of that data to find terrorist activity. I'm doing air quotes here. Mm-hmm. To identify possible terrorism leanings. These are all terrible ways to put it. But the whole point is to combine public and private information to see who you are and what you do and pick out the bad guys amongst us. Now, it was begun by DARPA, a group that we talked about a lot, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And there's a guy named John Poindexter, who was, I think he was a national security advisor at the time. I can't remember if he was the national security advisor at the time or back during Ronald Reagan's presidency, but I know he was at one point because he was involved in, you remember the Iran-Contra scandal? You ever heard of that? We've talked about it on this show. He was a big part of that. And according to the ACLU and history, he stated at that time during the Iran-Contra scandal that it was his duty to withhold information from Congress, you know, for their protection, for America's protection, for national security reasons.
He literally called Total Information Awareness a, quote, Manhattan Project for counterterrorism. So in his mind, the secrecy is part of it.
Well, think about it. On paper, theoretically, gathering all that online information could very, very well find people who are leaning towards, you know, doing something wrong, maybe. It could. But it also means that everybody else gets caught up in the dragnet. And then one agency or multiple agencies who are sharing the information have access to everybody. They've got literally a profile, like a school, what is it? The school record that you are always
your permanent record.
Your permanent record. Everybody's got one. And, you know, it used to be only the worst. The worst people had their FBI dossiers or whatever, or a file on them.
Or their jacket, it's called.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. But, you know, now through this program in the early 2000s, every American citizen would have one. And this thing was put into a bill. I believe it was the Homeland Security Act. That the TIA was put into, and eventually it was taken out because there was so much, you know, negative response towards this. Obviously, if you're a thinking person, this feels like an overstep, an overreach. And as our caller said, didn't necessarily go away. It kind of changed names as new security acts went through Congress and through the White House. This kind of gathering of information continued. And then we found out through Edward Snowden and several other whistleblowers that this thing was very much alive, you know, 2007, 2008 and onwards.
Yeah. It's a dragnet that never ends, and it has no constraints in terms of length of time of observation, right? There's nothing in there that says we can only watch people from 9 to 5. Monday through Friday.
I got to give you guys props for using the word dragnet. I don't hear that used in regular conversation very much. It's a great word.
But yeah,
kudos to for bringing it back.
Well, it's a great visual, right?
It is.
If
it
you
is.
Imagine that you're fishing, that's literally what this is. You just everything gets picked
everything.
Up.
Yeah, like dragging the lake, you know, looking for a body.
And I'm going to read really quickly to you guys from a New York Times opinion piece written by William Safire, maybe S-A or Safiri, S-A-F-I-R-E. It's from November 14th, 2002. And this is what he stated. If the Homeland Security Act is not amended before passage, that this is when the TIA was in there, here's what will happen to you. Every purchase you make with a credit card, every magazine subscription you buy and medical prescription you fill, every website you visit and email you send or receive, every academic grade you receive, every bank deposit you make, every trip you book, and every event you attend, all these transactions and communications will go into what the Defense Department describes as a virtual, centralized, grand database. Just to really put that, when it's combined like that in one long list, it just feels so icky. Mm-hmm. Yuck.
It should feel icky. The crazy thing is, this isn't the only one, right?
No.
This isn't the only fish of its fin in the sea. And there's also, from what I understand, it's not only increasingly easy to create something like this, but it's increasingly difficult for the average Jane or John citizen to fight against it, to opt out, you know, and not to dunk too hard on the U.S. If you don't think that other countries are doing this, if you don't think your country is doing this, you are being willfully naive. I was just listening to some of the recent news and research about Sesame Credit, particularly inspired by the rumors about the disappearance of the Chinese billionaire Ma.
Mm-hmm.
I say rumors about his disappearance. And then I learned some really disturbing things, not just about Sesame Credit, but about how so much control over user-generated internet forums like Reddit, so much of that stuff is coming from a single U.S. Air Force base.
No, really?
A lot of it was, and I can send you guys the links, but I think we have this illusion of safety or privacy. And privacy, as we understand it, we've said it before, didn't really exist for a long, long time, you know, like in days of yore, way before the internet, way before radio, way before television, they still didn't have what you might consider privacy today. People were living with their entire families in a single room on the farm, and you could hear what your parents were up to at night. That's not very private. So I think we're fooling ourselves when we have this idealized version of privacy. But well, I think we're also fooling ourselves if we say it's worth it to catch a potential terrorist. It's about control, I think.
Well, it is about control. I would just say, you know, the feeling of privacy was just a little different, I would say. And maybe it is all wool that we pulled over our own eyes in belief that such a thing exists. But it certainly felt different in the 50s, 60s prior to that. When, mm-hmm. you know, the communication that you're having with someone that is far away with, communication is probably one of the most vital things. Transactions are occurring if you're making them at a local bank, right? Or through a check that you've sent through the mail system. I'm just trying to think of other things. Electronic communication is happening over a phone. That's really it.
Well, I mean, Matt, do you think the expectation of privacy is just a thing of the past? Like, I mean, everybody knows that if you're banking or if you're like, you know, certain records are publicly available or whatever, and there's no expectation of privacy in that, you know, to keep people honest, I guess. But, you know, with things like phone calls or the mail or whatever, like there's been this sort of kind of waning sense of like, oh, I have the right to privacy. But do you think there's going to be a new generation where that's just not on people's minds anymore and people just understand that if they're communicating that it's pretty much fair game that someone's listening?
Yeah, 100%. Ben, and I'll let you continue with this, but I would just point out in the 1970s, you had programs like Echelon that we've talked about before. Promise software came out around that time. I don't know if we've talked about Blarney, but I know we hit a couple of these other programs that were meant to pull in any and all electronic communications. And they've been doing that for a long time. Mm-hmm. So now that we know about Stellar Wind, we know about Prism, we know about all these newer programs, I think privacy, at least to the upper echelons of the intelligence agencies within the United States, if you're a citizen here, as well if you're a citizen anywhere else on the planet, I think our expectation of privacy to them is gone. And also, and also to telecom agencies or companies, conglomerates, whatever. E-Corp and F-Corp and whichever other corp, they've got it all because we do it all through their services and we pay them for it.
Yeah, and every cup, like if that's a service, every cup we buy has these holes in it. You know what I mean? Like
it's a leaky cup. It's yeah, just, there's no expectation that your cup will hold your liquid anymore.
It's a sieve, and we didn't start today's episode planning to do prop comedy. That was just a Bob Ross happy accident. But yeah, you're right. I would advance though that there are a couple of other dangers here. Two that the ACLU clearly outlines, right? And the first, it's much easier for a government agency of any government to do this kind of thing now because you don't have to build the infrastructure. You just have to buddy up with a telecom that already has it and say, send me your stuff. Mm-hmm. And you can make a law that says they have to do so. And it's going to be hidden somewhere. It's going to be very difficult for other citizens to care about it, right? Because who has the time? I got to get back to Clubhouse and TikTok. I would love a Clubhouse invite. If someone wants to send us a Clubhouse
invite. Is that a beta situation? I just heard about this today. It's like an audio-based social media kind of, right?
Yeah. A lot of listeners have reached out to me and maybe to you guys as well saying, hey, why are you on Clubhouse? Are you guys going to do something on Clubhouse? To which the response is, I guess just send us an invite. It's still kind of, the way that Facebook originally was invite only and one had to go to a specific series of schools.
I'm really glad that you brought Facebook up.
good. Yes. because I've got another danger for you too,
yeah,
and
you
it's very much related to it.
You go ahead.
Okay, maybe this sets you up even better. So people who are in the realm of technology and ethics and the dangers of social media are doubtlessly familiar with the kind of one of the fathers of virtual reality, Jaron Lanier. I think he may have appeared on Social Dilemma. I can't remember, but he speaks widely about the dangers of social media. And I propose to you guys that these are inextricably linked with total information awareness type programs. Because look, so far what we've been talking about is the idea that TIA type stuff, these things are known as SIGADs, I believe, right? These signal intelligence collection dragnet things, they're presented to us as passive monitoring programs, right? Monitoring and analyzing data points and then trying to prevent crime. But what we have to remember is that when social media emerges, there's also a huge amount of research put in, brilliant, if evil, research put into changing people's behavior. You are part of a behavioral experiment. Every time you log on to Twitter, to Instagram, to Facebook, to anything like that, you know what I mean? Because there are different parties that are gathering your habits and they want to please their advertisers, right? So they can gradually push you toward something and you will not be aware that your behavior is changing unless you are very paranoid about it, constantly questioning why you believe something or where that belief came from. So I think Jaron Lanier is right, and I think it ties into this. I'm setting up a world where it's possible. In this conversation, we're setting up a world where it's possible for someone in charge of a SIGAD to do the same thing the FBI did when they were trying to radicalize members of the Islamic faith. You know, when the FBI tried to manufacture terrorists, that really happened. And with stuff like this, I'm not saying it's happened yet, but with stuff like this, it is feasible that they can do so.
There you go.
Sorry, it's stepping off the soapbox here. But
no, it's okay. I want to give some dates and bring it back to Facebook. So in 2003, 2000, well, really throughout the 2000s and after September 11, 2001, a type of dragnet program like TIA was in development. The thought of it being created was there, and it needed to get approved by Congress. You know, I told you it went through that Homeland Security Act, and it was a part of it, but it was struck down in 2003. Congress officially cut off funding to this program. I think it was called the Information Awareness Office. Correct me if I'm wrong there. Now, you know what was in development in 2003? Facebook, the Facebook. And in 2004, in February, the Facebook launched. Now, instead of some government dragnet going through and picking up where you go, where you eat, how you know who your friends are, with whom you interact, what you do on a regular basis, at that time, I don't think they were taking your billing information or collecting data about spending early on in Facebook's career, but they were collecting almost all of the information that these dragnets were pulling from. And we were users began in droves to give willingly their information to this other weird system that didn't need a dragnet. It just needed, it needed a box in which you could place all that stuff and then send out to somebody. And it's really interesting just to see that even though Congress, via the representatives of the citizens of this country, decided that this was a bad idea to give all of this information away, to pull in all of this information and keep it all, track it all, we chose as individuals collectively to give almost all of that away willingly. And we give away our bank information, our credit card information to third parties through apps all the time. We do that all the time.
But they wouldn't do anything nefarious with it. I mean, it's all encrypted, right? It's all trustworthy.
In the end, it's weird. It's data points. It doesn't matter if anyone or some company or some app has access to exactly what you spent your money on and where. They, you know, the metadata within that information is sometimes more powerful.
Yeah, it paints a picture of a person that then can be bought and sold.
Mm-hmm. A persona. Yeah. It's mm-hmm. literally called that in marketing. It can also be used to, it can be used in a lot of sticky ways. Like the dystopian version of this, the closest we have to a dystopian version that is real now is what's sometimes called Sesame Credit or Sima Credit in China. And recently, the public has grown very concerned there because we called it. We said it's not always going to be opt-in. Now there's another version that's for corporations. Recently, I think just a few weeks ago, a 9-year-old girl was found liable by court for her dead father's debts, and she was punished under China's social credit system because she couldn't pay those debts because, you know, she's 9.
Yeah.
So
jeez.
This has sparked a little bit of public outcry, but the proverbial horse may have already left the barn here. And the problem is that the advantages of a surveillance state for anybody who wants to maintain the status quo, that's ultimately what we're talking about. Preventing terrorism, sure, but also preventing dissident activity, right?
And thought.
And no free think. Right? None of that. And then also you can imagine this. Imagine the insider trading capabilities you have with this. You're one of the government heads of this program. How far away are we from a world where you can say, I have a lot of stock in LA Lights? Those are the shoes that light up, right? Yeah. When you walk. No. I have a lot of stock in LA Lights. Let's bring those back. Let's bring back LA Lights. And then you just fiddle some gears. You got some science noise going on in the background. Boop, 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 yeah. Boop, boop. And the likes start pouring in and the ads start selling. And then you are an LA Light lumineer. That's too much. You're an LA Lights tycoon. It's possible.
Or, you know, you have a lot of stock in Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, YouTube, AOL, Skype, Apple. And you're just, you know, because those companies are working directly or were working directly with the PRISM program that was just siphoning information off to the NSA. So yeehaw. I'm pretty sure you could trade your butt off if you had all that info. Yuck. Hey, guys, there's more to talk about here, but I think we should move on. Is that all right?
I think it's the only sane solution for the moment. Yes.
It's the new year.
It's the new year.
The government's still taking all your stuff.
Let's keep it up. Wait, you mean flipping over to 2021 didn't just like solve all our problems? That's a bummer.
Yeah. It's all good. It's all good. But hey, thank you so much, anonymous person who told us that cool story and made this discussion happen. We hope you enjoyed that. And we will see you all after this quick word from our sponsor.
All right, and we're back with a slightly more upbeat story, a little bit less of a, you know, dystopian 1984 on steroids kind of situation that Matt's story painted a pretty very vivid picture of. It's important stuff to know, but good Lord, sometimes I just feel like we're like fighting against the current, you know what I mean? Like, ugh. My goodness gracious. But here's the thing. All of these dystopian ideations that I think we're all subject to now, they can bring about some pretty serious mental struggles. I think we've all experienced it during COVID and during being isolated. And, you know, things like anxiety and depression are on the rise. And certainly these are things that one can be predisposed to. But it's also something that your environment can just kind of bring on, or just your circumstances. And I think we've all been struggling in our own ways with the circumstances that 2020 dumped on us. But there's good news, my friends. There's good news because there are some substances that have in the past been highly regulated, outlawed, and maligned that are kind of seeing a new day, a new future where they could potentially be used legally to help us with some of these things that I'm talking about. And to hear about that, we will hear the experience of a listener named Steve who called in to tell us his story.
Hey guys, I just wanted to call. I've been calling a lot lately, but this is Steve from Denver. And I just wanted to call to talk about psilocybin. It's been a while since I've heard something about it from you guys. I was straight edge my whole life, literally never did anything. And then when I was about 40, depression was hitting me so hard, I didn't want to do pharmaceuticals or any of that junk. And so after 15 years of looking into psychedelics and such, I decided I was going to try mushrooms as a remedy to my depression and anxiety, and it worked. My first trip was pretty incredible, and my wife and I took our first trip together, and nothing but positive stuff about it. Since then, it's every 2 to 3 months, I would say, that I need some kind of a reset. I don't microdose. I do a lot of psilocybin at once, and I basically go to outer space and fight my demons while riding a rocket made of drugs, I guess. Anyway, it works for me. I'd be interested in you guys taking a new look at the new outlook on psilocybin and other drugs as to treat addiction and depression and things of that nature. Thanks for the show. Take care.
Steve, I was really hoping you were going to say a rocket made of unicorn tears or something like that, but drugs is also fine. That's the thing, this idea of drugs, you know, the war on drugs and the idea of drugs being something that is maligned and treated with disdain by the powers that be, and the idea that, like, you know, substances that grow naturally from the earth should be uprooted and regulated and kept from people. And there's a really fantastic documentary called, I think it's literally called Fantastic Fungi, that just came out that I've only seen a little bit of, and I can't wait to watch the whole thing, but it goes into a lot of the new uses for psilocybin that Steve was talking about and that we've talked about on the show in the past, and that we actually have an upcoming episode where we're going to go into it a little deeper. But I think we can stick, for the purposes of this conversation, maybe to just the way the tide has turned in the way that Steve is talking about. And you can measure that in a couple of ways, but one of them is with money, IPOs by pharmaceutical companies, and pharmaceutical companies getting invested in magic mushrooms to treat things like depression or even neuropathic pain. And this all comes from a recent study by Johns Hopkins University that looked at the effects of psilocybin-assisted therapy on major depressive disorder. And it found in a randomized clinical trial of 24 participants with major depressive disorder that those who received immediate psilocybin treatment compared with delayed treatment showed improvement in what they referred to as blinded clinician rater assessed depression severity. And also in self-reported secondary outcomes. So that's sort of a fancy way of saying they got better quicker, those that took the psilocybin. And when you get these studies like this, not immediately, but I just, like I said, the tide seems to be turning with things like marijuana legalization and now psilocybin legalization that was just made completely legal in Oregon. And if I'm not mistaken, Portland, Oregon, just like legalized like all drugs. Did I make that up?
No.
Something, yeah, that's a thing. So with psilocybin in particular, it's like obviously recreational use is fun and that people enjoy doing that to, you know, trip on mushrooms and listen to music, go to a concert. But it turns out that all of the things you've read, people like Terrence McKenna and all of these psychonauts, you know, from throughout, you know, modern history, it does make some interesting neurological connections that can help people deal with things like depression or end of life or the more clinical kind of use of treating pain. And there actually is a brand new upcoming initial public stock offering from a company in Canada called Trip Pharmaceuticals. And James Kuo, who is the CEO of the California-based Trip Therapeutics, rather, is the name of the company. He is expecting to go public on the Canadian Securities Exchange. And that happened. This article was from, let's see, this article was from the 17th of December. So that will have happened by now. And he believes that his company will, they're not interested in recreational. They're jumping off of studies like this Johns Hopkins study. And they're interested in being kind of the, you know, standard bearer of using psilocybin to treat these conditions that we're talking about. So it feels like the tide is turning. And I think we've probably all heard the term microdose thrown around so much lately. It's something that people very casually do. And it doesn't make you like messed up. It just kind of, you know, grounds people a little bit. And it's something that's very, very popular, almost to the point of becoming a bit cliche. But I just think the future of psilocybin, you know, therapy is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's a smart move, right? It certainly functioned really well for the burgeoning cannabis industry and in normalizing cannabis use across the United States, like putting it as a medicinal use first and then transitioning eventually into more, you know, open use of the substance. I'm looking at this website for Therasil, another company. Then there are many of these other companies that are attempting to find ways to introduce psilocybin into some kind of medical treatment. And it is, as you said, usually aimed at anxiety, depression, the state in which many of us find ourselves on a pretty constant basis. I think it's nice to imagine it being more ubiquitous in that realm rather than some kind of medication that's in a pill form that, you know, some company is going to make just billions of dollars a year off of until they get sued to oblivion because they started some kind of epidemic.
Well, yeah, we see also, you know, similar things happening with marijuana, decriminalization and legalization, and started with a medicinal urge. I want to step back here just to address several things. Steve, first off, thank you so much for sending in this awesome voicemail. And you're right. We have heard you. We have heard from you, and I am, I can't remember if you've told us about this in a past call, but I fell into a rabbit hole figuring out your accent, Steve. And I think it's super cool. So I would love to hear about your journey there. I would also posit that I would ask, is this the forefront of new medicine, or is this the resurgence of ancient medicine? We did some previous work on the possible relationship between early religious experiences and hallucinogens. And there are a lot of great writers out there, fringe, but great writers, who will argue that hallucinogens have played an integral role in our cognitive development, or our social development, maybe, is a better way to put it, over time. I think it was Bill Hicks has this great piece on the use of hallucinogens. We do want to say, I think this speaks to your point you just made, Matt, we do want to say that psilocybin, magic mushrooms, they're not the same thing as LSD. They're not the same thing as some other hallucinogens, like ayahuasca is going to give you a different experience in comparison to something like DMT or something like psilocybin. So a lot of these laws being relaxed are specifically, I believe this is correct, Noel, they're specifically for psilocybin, right? They're not all hallucinogens.
That's correct. Now, it's very specifically for psilocybin. And taking it even a step further, there are companies working on developing synthetic psilocybin, which is a whole new class of drug for treatment of these same things, especially these neuropsychiatric disorders.
Mm-hmm. And it's weird because public opinion is a little bit divided. Well, public opinion is very divided here in the United States because everyone alive in the U.S. has in some way been affected by what's called the war on drugs. If not directly, your mind has been affected. Because, like, how many people just heard us say the phrase war on drugs and had a PSA playing in their heads? What did you guys get? The egg? I get the egg too. Matt, what you got?
It wasn't the egg. Because it wasn't a video or anything or a PSA. It was just people in my face as a child telling me how bad drugs are. That's all I remember. It's just faceless, nameless people that are just like, drugs are bad.
Like, McGruff the crime dog.
Okay.
I think we've talked about this before. Yeah, I know we've talked about this before, but yeah. I had someone come to my school with a giant suitcase. Right. Full of every drug. And I think Ben and I, we've mentioned that it just kind of was like, ooh, I want to try that one and try that one and try that one. But it was just kind of a funny little technique that they use. I don't think it quite went the way they were hoping.
I don't think so either, but I always love a good presentation. It had a science fair vibe because it's one of those like trifold cases, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And prop comedy, I know you're a fan of.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Regular Carrot Top, our local DARE program was. I'm kidding. No, their hearts were in the right place. They were doing the best they could. But just like an abstinence program, statistically, we see the results don't bear out. We also should shout out the fantastic work that Robert Lamb and Joe McCormick have done on hallucinogens and psilocybin specifically over at Stuff to Blow Your Mind. I would recommend checking them out if you haven't already yet, Steve. And I think we could dive into this further because psilocybin has also been used in experiments with ESP, I think. It's been used in experiments to help people break bad habits such as smoking tobacco, or I believe it's also hasn't been used. Am I thinking of psilocybin when I say it's been used in alcoholism treatment?
Just addiction, period. It's a great way of like breaking habits, breaking patterns. And those patterns might be physical and a lot of them are mental. And that's sort of what depression is. It's negative mental patterns and cyclical thinking. And a lot of it, you know, is just getting caught up in your own story and not being able to like see the big picture. And hallucinogens are often credited in giving people kind of like this spiritual step back to kind of like zoom out and see the whole picture and be able to kind of see where they fit into it instead of like being so myopic, you know, in everything they do, because it's really easy to get pigeonholed and like in a rut that way. But one last thing on my end, they are seeking FDA approval and it's going quite well, as it turns out. Trip Therapeutics in the past, through several rounds of venture capitalist, you know, just fundraising, I guess, raised $1.5 million Canadian through two rounds over the past eight or 9 months. And they are looking at this upcoming IPO to help fund the development of an oral formulation of psilocybin that would be used to treat soft tissue sarcoma. And they've already started the process of seeking FDA approval.
To treat cancer?
To treat, I would imagine, the pain that goes along with cancer. And they're confident that they will be able to get FDA approval eventually after this IPO. Kuo, who is the, I believe, the CEO of Trip Therapeutics, said they can enter directly into a second phase of clinical studies before getting official FDA approval because we've already seen efficacy in these drugs. And he says, since these drugs have been proved to be safe to use during the first phase of the trial. And here's a quote. There are two things you need to show for any drug to be approved, safety and efficacy. We can answer that it's safe, but still need more data to prove its efficaciousness. And studies like that Johns Hopkins study is a step in the right direction towards doing that.
And I think that's specifically addressing the treatment of existential distress for the
Correct.
Cancer patients.
That's right.
The fear of death.
That's exactly right.
Haunts us all. There are some objections. There are a couple of objectors, a couple of people. I wouldn't say they're going full 1980s war on drugs opposition to this, but they are saying we should slow down because we don't know enough about it. That's one of the big arguments, right? Michael Pollan, you might recognize him from the Omnivore's Dilemma. He acknowledges that psilocybin is, first off, it is weirdly safe. In terms of a medicine, it is weirdly safe. There is no known lethal dose yet. Nobody that we know of in history has ever ingested so much psilocybin that they die from that. But of course, Steve, to your comment about the rocket of drugs, on a high enough dose, people will have badly impaired judgment and may do things that are incredibly dangerous. And when we talk about the researchers, Johns Hopkins, London, other places who are gathering volunteers for these very important, these crucial clinical trials, we have to realize they're screened very, very carefully because we're talking about mental conditions in many ways, you know? And when we talk about mental conditions, we're going into a realm that we, even the experts in our species, do not fully understand. And how does that compound with other drug interactions? If someone is, say, for instance, on a treatment plan for psilocybin while they're also on a treatment plan for an antidepressant of some sort, right? Is Wellbutrin an antidepressant?
Yeah, but it also works really well for smoking cessation, which is interesting.
Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah. So we don't know all the effects. So just to give a voice to the people who are saying, not so fast. The weird thing that I see is I don't see anybody saying, no, stop, don't do it ever.
Totally.
I just see people saying we need to do some more homework.
Well, I also, it's funny to say not so fast for a substance that's literally been around since the Stone Age, you know?
Right.
I mean, people have been taking psychedelics as long as they've been growing out of the ground. So it's like, I think the proof is in the pudding, you know? And you're right. I think they were like things like Go Ask Alice, that very, very not real, but seeming autobiography of a young woman taking drugs who have, spoiler alert for a piece of propaganda that they make you read in high school. I think she ends up throwing herself off a building at the end on a bad trip or something like that. But I mean, it's like reefer madness, kind of, you know, a lot of it really is just trumped up kind of worst case scenario fear mongering that, you know, and look what we're talking about here. We're talking about a substance that can treat pain in the way that things like OxyContin treat pain, you know, and OxyContin is heavily addictive. And so many things that big pharma pushes are heavily addictive, which I think is the large drive behind why these things have been illegal for so long. So interested to see where this goes. I think it's high time. That was not on purpose. But let's take another quick break, and then we'll be back with another message from you.
And we have returned. Folks, fellow conspiracy realists, as I said at the top of the show, one of these segments may not be appropriate for all listeners in the audience. The following will contain graphic and completely true accounts of some very disturbing things. So in the interest of time, without too much prologue, let's roll the final piece of listener mail today, a call that we received from an anonymous source with a very good question.
Hey, guys, long-time listener of the show. Quick question. Have you all ever done an episode of the UN sex scandal? I think it's, I was looking at it earlier and found something on Reddit, but I wasn't able to get in to read more articles due to the paywalls and et cetera, et cetera. But it seems like a charity work scandal where it says over 60,000 women and children have been raped over the past decade. If you all have, please let me know, and I would be really interested in listening to it or, you know, discuss it on the show. Thanks.
Thank you so much for calling, for reaching out to us with this incredibly important point, Anonymous. First, I've been aware of this. I believe that we all are somewhat aware of this. We have not done a show on this. It is a very real thing. It's a very real series of conspiracies, not conspiracy theories. So it dates back to, I think it first hits the news around 2017. There's an investigation by the Associated Press that goes public and shows that more than 100 UN peacekeepers were running a sexual abuse ring, specifically in Haiti, for Whoa. Over a decade, and they were never jailed. That's the headline. There had been more than 1,000 allegations of similar abuse and exploitation by UN peacekeepers and other personnel across the planet over the 12 years before that. The U.S. ambassador to the UN at the time, someone named Nikki Haley, urged all these countries to try and hold U.S. peacekeepers accountable for this kind of abuse. And when we say abuse, we're talking about things like forced sex work, out-and-out kidnapping and sexual assaults, rapid increases in these terrible events in countries like not just Haiti, but Cambodia, Mozambique, Kosovo, Bosnia, after the UN and NATO peacekeeping forces moved in. There is a clear correlation. And of course, we're not saying that, I hope everybody knows that when we talk about these things, we're not saying the entirety of the UN peacekeeping forces, but it definitely happened. And like so many things, it got reported and then it sort of fell from the public eye. Do you guys remember hearing about this a few years back?
I never did, which is really surprising because, I mean, I'm familiar with Oxfam largely because Radiohead were always a huge supporter of Oxfam, and like Tom York like auctioned off some handwritten lyrics to, you know, the proceeds going towards Oxfam, and they're like a hugely respected and influential charity in the UK, and that's really mostly what I've known about them. I can't believe I haven't heard any of this.
Yeah, I didn't realize minors, like children, 12 and 13 year old kids were involved. The whole thing is already disturbing. Just the fact that sexual abuse of any kind was taking place and it seemed to be institutionalized by at least one, I think they called it one boss, right? At least in the reporting. But then there were numerous other staff members. Oh God. Yeah.
Right. Now you can find reporting about this. The Guardian has an excellent timeline. There are a number of other deep dive works of journalism on this analysis. In addition to this widespread systemized abuse, there was also, as you alluded to, Matt, there was also definitely a cover-up. I believe you are referring to the country director in Haiti, Roland Van Houwerman. He was in charge of Oxfam activities in Haiti at the time. He was instrumental in this cover-up, it seems to be the case. We would have to dive in and do more research to make a full episode to really get a sense of him. But a lot of this happened following the 2010 earthquake, which wreaked enormous chaos upon the country of Haiti, which already had infrastructure problems, resource extraction problems, and so on and so on. Now, one thing that stands out to our astute listeners here is we've talked about UN peacekeeping forces and we've talked about Oxfam. Oxfam is the charitable organization you're talking about, Anonymous, and it is a nonprofit leviathan. It's a nonprofit octopus. It's made of 20 different independent charitable organizations that all sort of team up in an Avengers Justice League way in 1942 to alleviate global poverty. They have offices around the world. They have done a ton of, really solid, inarguably important and beneficial work. They have also clearly covered up these sexual abuse scandals, not just in Haiti, but in Chad, in other countries. And what's strange here, and what should disturb people, is the lack of accountability. Because think about this. If you are a predator, the way that some of these people definitely were, then you are naturally going to look for people who are already having a terrible, terrible time. You know what I mean? Like, I would say also, just to further draw a bright line around this, Oxfam was doing this. UN peacekeepers were doing this too. So Oxfam does work with the UN, but the people who are peacekeepers, who are the on-the-ground soldiers and forces, those folks were doing this too. This is very dirty, very quickly, and it's terrible because UN staff, like that number you made up, Anonymous, 60,000 events over the course of a decade, that number is very real. That comes from an estimate from a former senior official of the United Nations, one Andrew McLeod. And it's just strange to me that we don't hear too much about this now. We know that as far back as 1996, the UN did a study about this, which you can read online, called The Impact of Armed Conflict on Children. And then they said, the UN, NATO, Oxfam, you know, they had their own investigations. And there's a bit of a bad apple argument here, which is that we can't throw out all the good work that these organizations are doing because of the actions of a few bad actors. But the question of, like, how many is a few? You know what I mean? Where is the accountability? And where is the justice for these people who are suffering?
Yeah. I was looking at this in that Guardian article, Ben, the one Oxfam's disgraced Haiti official left earlier post over sex parties. This is a separate article that's linked off the one we were looking at. Apparently that guy, what's his name? Van Hauermeeren. He apparently had to leave another charity organization because of allegations that he was apparently having sex parties. This is a quotation from this article. Sex parties with local women while operating in, I think, Liberia.
Following the timeline, it seems like Oxfam at large investigated this with about the same like fervor as the Catholic Church investigated child sex allegations for a time. You know, it felt like a real sweeping under the rug kind of situation. You know, all this happened back in 2011, or the investigation rather. And it was just kind of, well, what are we going to do? Kind of.
Eventually was forced to resign, but that's not the same thing as going to jail, is it? We should also say, you know, the UN regularly partners with Oxfam to do what they call implementation of programs and operations. But you're right, Noel, this, for something to have been going on this long, there's no easy answer. And it does seem like there's collusion within the organization, or at the very least, either a huge lack of oversight to a level of incompetence that is difficult to believe, or a tacit agreement to look the other way.
Ben, this is the kind of stuff that it's no wonder that something like Pizzagate gains so much traction, because there are real stories like this that come out all the time where like we're talking about, we told you guys already, 12, 13 year olds were caught up in the stuff going on in Haiti. I'm looking now at the stuff in 2004, 2008 in other countries where there were young people, not necessarily children, but very young people being caught up with these same individuals who are all working for charity to literally save the children.
Yeah.
And doing this, you know, if the people who are supposed to be doing some of the most noble and best things that you can possibly do, this kind of charity work, this kind of giving to somebody else who doesn't have as much as you. That, you know, you imagine that's some of the best people in the world, but good God, for someone who's able to do that and this other thing simultaneously, it's just, it boggles the mind to the point where it makes you question everything.
Humanity.
All intentions.
I mean, that level of taking advantage, you know, when you're in a position where you're supposed to be the helping hand that takes someone who's in a bad place, and you're supposed to be that arm that extends out, and instead you reach out and slap them. It's disheartening is what it is. But I try not to let it like wreck my whole view of humanity, because I know good people. There are good people, and there are people that are doing good work, and this isn't representative of all of them. But God, when you hear stories like this, it makes you take a pause.
So one thing I have found that may be somewhat mitigating news for you, Anonymous, and for all of us listening along at home, is I looked into the history of that figure, right? The 60,000 over a decade. It's a large number of people over a long amount of time. But when we look into some of the specifics, it gets a little bit dodgy. So McLeod, the man we had said, the former senior official who came up with that figure, he originally came up with it in an interview in The Sun. And when the BBC asked him to walk through the calculus of that, here's what he did. And he explained it to him. He's pretty transparent. He said, okay, in 2016, the UN internal reports say that there were about 311 cases of sexual abuse by peacekeepers during that year. And then he saw additional UN research that said these numbers are probably higher. This is just the stuff that made it through the reporting process. And so he decided he would double that annual figure, 622, right? And then he decided he would multiply that by 10, because generally only about 10% of these sorts of cases are reported in general. And that's what brought him to 6,000. And then he multiplied that by 10 again to cover a 10-year period. Other people in the international development and aid community have a tough time with this methodology. You know what I mean? Because one of the things we have to be very careful about whenever we're reporting on crimes like this is not to be too sensationalistic. That's how you get, to your point, Matt, that's how you find yourself at these sort of Pizzagate situations. The stuff with the Catholic Church, definitely real. The Dutroux affair, definitely real. And the Belgian government was in on it. Not for nothing did 300,000 people march in that country. And this stuff, this Oxfam UN stuff, it is real. It did happen. But we owe it to the survivors of these horrendous events to be accurate. You know what I mean? It doesn't help to turn it into some sort of sensationalistic yellow journalism line unless we have the proof. And we need the proof as a species, because we have to arm ourselves with information to prevent things like this from happening again. We cannot emphasize this enough. Before these people have been victimized, they're living in some of the most challenging situations on the planet. And many times they've been born into these situations. It's stunning to me, because to your point, Noel, the entire mission of these people on paper is to help make the world a slightly better place. How dare you do the opposite?
Now, well said, Ben.
Well, gosh. You know what? Maybe it's all the coffee. Actually, we're on the fence. This is one of those that's important for us to cover. It's very much the mission of the show. It's a conspiracy. It's a cover-up. It's real. But also, it's a very terrible thing, you know? We go back and forth sometimes on episodes like this, or, you know, if we make these full episodes, on what we can do in our position on this little podcast of ours. Are we helping this situation? You know what I mean? And that's a question that we try to address in each case. But all to say, you are correct, Anonymous. The story you read about is unfortunately very real. For Oxfam's part, Oxfam in specific, you can visit oxfamamerica.org And you will see that they have acknowledged the events in Haiti, at least. They have also instituted some significant steps to address the problems that they say, quote, allowed the events in Haiti to happen. So they have a commission reviewing cases of sexual misconduct, abuse of power. They're putting more resources into keeping people safe. And they're working with other people and the other peers and groups in the development sector to try to tackle this kind of abuse overall. You can also read a full copy of their final internal report on the events and the sexual misconduct and other behavior during this time in Haiti. So I would say also just a brief word of thanks and encouragement to the people who are compiling those reports, to the people who are doing this, who have done this look into their own organization. Think about every show about an institution, whether it's a very large religious one like the Catholic Church or whether it's an institution like law enforcement. The people who are internal affairs, who have to go in and ask questions of their own people, they're always kind of the bad guys, right? Like, that's how they're depicted in, what, The Wire and countless other cop shows. So these folks are doing the real life version of that. I'm grateful that these kind of things are around, but we have to do better. Agreed. And with that, we know we're running long, wanted to give space. We didn't want to be this last story to be something thrown away at the end, but we did want to save it for that disclaimer. We would like to hear your experience. If you have worked in international development, if you have worked with NGOs, or if you have worked with Oxfam, what is the culture like? What was your experience? How much of this story, we've just taken a brief look at it now, how much of it has been sensationalized by the media? Are we not hearing the whole story still? If so, let us know. Thank you also to Steve. Let us know about your experience with psilocybin and other hallucinogens insofar as you are comfortable. And we would love to hear it, especially if it helped you address depression, if it helped you address addiction of some sort. We would just love to hear your personal experience. And also, hey, if you're working for what is it, musculature?
Muscular.
Yeah. If you're working for muscular, you're a former employee of one of the Five Eyes programs, then I don't know. Do you need to let us know? Like, do we even need to tell you where to find us? You already know.
Yeah, just, you know, show yourself on one of our screens Matrix style one night. And we'll hang. Good golly. Hey, I'm gonna do the phone number, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, this thing has me in a dark pit. Let's keep going. If you want to get in touch with us like your fellow listeners did today, please call our number. It is 1-833-STDWYTK. You've got 3 minutes to leave a message. You can leave as many as you want. It's helpful for us from a time perspective if you leave one concise, really powerful message. That we would appreciate that if you could do that. If you don't want to call us, you can always find us on social media. And one of the best places there is on Facebook, believe it or not, after we just talked about giving all your info up to them. Check out Here's Where It Gets Crazy, our community page. It is fantastic, amazing mods, great community. We love hanging out and talking there. And you can talk with your fellow listeners about this and any other topic we've discussed on the show.
If you don't want to do that and you're a little bit more, find yourself in sort of more of an old school zone, you can get in touch with us on the internet via a more old fashioned way. That is via email, where we are.
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.